Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's the 13th of April, 2012, and today we're joined by a Syrian commentator called Syrian Girl. She's a Syrian national who is choosing to keep her identity and her location private for fear of retribution against herself and her family, obviously, understandable. And so it's great to have Syrian Girl here. She's been making the rounds on YouTube. She's available at youtube.com/partisangirl. Is that right?
I believe it's Syrian Girl Partisan.
Syrian Girl Partisan, and on Twitter at Partisan Girl.
That's right.
Okay, excellent. Well, now we know a little bit about where people can find your work online, but let's talk a little bit about yourself. Obviously, you are choosing to keep your identity private, which is understandable, but also understandable, I think a lot of viewers and listeners might be wary of people who are keeping their identity private, and we don't know the background, because we've seen people like Syrian Danny and others, of course, being touted in the mainstream media as commentators on Syria, and they've been exposed as frauds in a number of different ways. So let's talk a little bit about your bona fides, where you're coming from, your background, and what qualifies you as a commentator on Syria.
Well, as I openly said on the Alex Jones show and on other interviews, the only thing I'm secretive about is my name, age, location. Everything else, I'm going to be completely honest and open about. My family background, I was born in Damascus, Syria. I've lived there. I've been there many times. I have family there, a lot of family. Actually, the vast majority of my family is there. So I have a lot of knowledge about what's happening there. And also, I've always been interested in geopolitics mainly. So I understand it not just from a local perspective, but from a global perspective as well. At least I think I do. But I don't have any university qualifications pertaining to politics, not yet anyway. I'm more in the science field, but when you have an interest in something, I'm not sure if you can call me an expert, but when it comes to my region, I guess I am.
Well, that is certainly understandable, and I think a lack of university credentials is by no means a handicap. In some ways, it might even be a benefit, certainly with the state of the indoctrination system. But let's expand that out a little bit. As I understand it, some of your family background, it actually has ties to the former incarnation of the Syrian government, and it's a canard that people like to bring out when we're talking about these types of issues. If you are against the NATO humanitarian love bombing of Syria, you must be a supporter of Assad and blindly supporting his government. I think your background shows that is not the case in this case, but perhaps you can expand on that.
Well, actually, my family, as I said previously, was the former ruling class family before the coup happened in the 60s, which brought the Ba'athists to power. And my grandfather was actually a general in government. And he was booted out because he wasn't a Ba'athist. So he was a war hero that fought against the French occupation. So he was, one of the most highest generals. But after he was kicked out, they also confiscated some of the land that he possessed. And also on the other side of my family, also land was confiscated. So I was brought up to think that the government is corrupt, things like that. But as I grow up and make my own opinions about everything, for some people it's absolutely true, you know. And there is a lot of corruption in the government. I would be the first to say that. And if I was running the country, I would run it differently internally. However, for some people, the government is good. You know, for some people, it took them from poverty and brought them to a middle class level because it ran under a socialist position. Unfortunately, you know, sometimes people, no matter who the government is, poor people remain so. They remain poor. For that reason, they can sometimes be taken advantage of. And it's an unfortunate way that the way the world works. But, you know, even in these communist, so-called communist countries, people still starve. So the fact is there are poor people in Syria, but, you know, not all of them are opposed to the government. You can't just say one group is opposed, one group isn't. There is a trend I have seen, though, and that is a lot of the opposition to the government is coming outside of Syria, and people of my own class, like people who have been downtrodden, former ruling class people, former rich people who left Syria, took their money with them, and have a hatred towards the government. I've seen these activists in Canada and whatnot. They haven't even been to Syria in their lives, but their parents told them how evil the government is. And there's something you can't ignore, and there's a big sectarian undertone behind the reasoning of these people. You know, they see it as those Alawites who were peasants are now the ruling class, and it's unacceptable. And these Alawite sect have to be constantly put down, and that is one of the reasons to hate. And what also comes into that is the whole religious thing, because Alawites are a sect of Islam, and you know, the former ruling class was probably primarily Christians and Sunnis. So this is big sectarian thing, and the way you can see that is that they often attack Iran and Hezbollah, which are Shia, which is a sect that's close to Alawis. So they don't even hide it. You know, it's quite out in the open. And they even mention the Alawis, this and Alawis, that. But in fact, you know, the government, while there may be nepotism amongst the Alawi class, it is a secular government. That's how it runs. It doesn't oppress any one religious group. So while there's, of course, corruption when it comes to money, I think that's evident in a lot of countries. And I'm not used to talking about the internal problems of Syria, because I feel that that's something to do with Syrians only. So I don't really want to go into every detail, because people will use it against Syria. You know, outsiders, not all, outside governments, they have no sympathy for people. They just use sympathy for their own agenda. So I hope I made my position clear about the Syrian government.
I think so. Well, there's an awful lot to talk about. So let's jump into some of the latest news and use that as a springboard for the conversation. And we have a report out from Reuters that's just come out a few hours ago. Syrian forces clash with rebels near Turkey. And when you start to read through this report, these reports of Assad's forces clashing with Turkish forces near the border, it sources back to this British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which has been the source of a lot of information coming out of Syria that is all, of course, negative towards Assad and what's happening there. Perhaps you can talk a little bit about these human rights organizations like the Syrian Observatory and others that are really the main source for pretty much every report in the Western mainstream media on Syria right now.
Well, these non-government organizations and humanitarian organizations are just a tool to badmouth and create a reason for war. They're not, in fact, humanitarian, and they're partisan. They're not neutral, and you can see even the United Nations Human Rights Watch is not neutral. You know, everybody says that these organizations are, they have this perception of holiness and caring, but in fact, they're just yet another tool used by governments to attack other countries. And even in the UN Human Rights Watch, some of the top members of that were formerly in the US government. So you can see that, and worked under Clinton and it's obvious that these people are not neutral. So why would they speak neutrally about Syria? And especially these, they're not even within Syria, they're outside Syria, like the British Human Rights Observatory. So I don't think there's any credibility that these organizations have. And I think they're heavily funded by George Soros. I know that he funds a lot of NGOs, and he seems to be behind a lot of these colored revolutions we're seeing around the globe. And this is just another one. This time it's Syria. And I wanted to say something, but now.
Well, I think that what
the, I wanted to get back to the Turkey. Sorry, go ahead.
Absolutely. Well, let me just bring this in, because I think what the report here about the skirmish along the Turkish border, etc., what these types of reports are pointing to is the fact that since basically the moment that this UN brokered peace deal went into effect, it seems the media has been looking for any excuse to declare that Assad has already broken the deal, etc., etc. And I think this is just another aspect of that. Let's talk about this UN-backed deal and what it's really seeking to do. I noticed that you have a recent report where you speculate that it might just be a way of biding time so that the opposition can rearm. And it seems that perhaps that might be the case, as unfortunately there's already signs of violence continuing in Homs and other areas.
Well, that's exactly right. I agree with your analysis. They're trying to pick hold in the ceasefire as soon as it started. And I think one of the purposes, as I said, is to rearm. But I think also another purpose is to find yet another excuse to enter into Syria. So you make a ceasefire, you let it fail. And that makes you have an excuse to say, well, you know, Syrian government doesn't want to have peace, doesn't want to make deals. Now we have to have some kind of intervention. So I think that's yet another tool of these so-called ceasefires. And we can discuss, if you like, the terms of these ceasefires. The first thing is that as soon as it happened, suddenly, the Turkish border, there was a skirmish. And one wonders, who does this benefit? Does it benefit the Syrian government at this in this current climate to agree to a ceasefire and then to immediately fire at the Turkish border? I really doubt that. And I think on the Global Research website, there's actually a video of the event as it occurred. And I welcome all those to have a look at that and see for themselves. And going now to the news, you see that they are talking about how the Syrian military has not left Homs, and how that's so terrible, and how they've violated the terms of the ceasefire, when in fact the terms of the ceasefire did not give a specific deadline for withdrawal, only a timeline for withdrawal. And that is the only reason why Syria agreed to it. Because there's no way that Syria is going to withdraw and let these armed gangs return into Homs and just retrench themselves into the towns that have just been freed of them. So it's just barking dogs, and they're barking yet again, except now they're painting it as, because of this tank still in Homs, the UN observers have to be sent in. The UN observers were going to be sent in anyway. That was part of the whole deal. So I don't see how the media is painting it like, because the ceasefire failed, now we're going to have to send in the observers. But what Syria has, the people that are going to be sent in are going to be decided in the Security Council resolution today. So in Syria's perspective, I hope, I can't speak for the government, but it's my analysis that they were going to choose countries that are friendly to Syria. Russia, China.
Well, that would make sense.
I wanted to talk about other...
Well, let's just expand on that point for a moment, because it would make sense, obviously, to have Russia and China involved in this process. And I think that's probably part of the the point of this type of Security Council resolution to enforce the monitors, which Syrian government has already accepted and was already part of that peace process, as you say. What's the point of passing a Security Council resolution on this, if not to try to corner Assad into that position whereby any violence that occurs from here on out will be blamed on him, thus giving that Security Council the foot in the door to say he violated the plan, thus we have now the right to intervene?
This is exactly how it is. It was built to fail. And even when the government requested that the opposition groups just sign a document that says they will stick to the ceasefire, the U.S. said, no way. You know, they're not even agreeing. The opposition is not even agreeing to the ceasefire. And yet, whenever fighting happens, immediately the government of Syria is blamed. It's really arrogant and just unfair. And the fact is that they don't want there to be peace in Syria. I mean, let's admit it right out. The U.S., NATO, they don't want to see a ceasefire. They don't want to see peace in Syria. They want to continuously destabilize the country because it suits their agenda, in spite of what they say. And they have said time and time again that they want to see the government of Syria fall. So why would they want peace to happen? They don't. And they were going to do everything in their power to undermine peace.
Well, that seems to be the point. Well, let's talk about the underlying hypocrisy of the very precept here that there needs to be some sort of coordinated international community involvement in what, as you say, is the internal matters of Syrian politics. And let's contrast that, for example, to the American electorate, where the U.S. Congress once again reaching all-time lows this year with approval ratings now in the single digits. So less than one out of every 10 Americans actually approves of what their Congress is doing. Yet we don't see UN Security Council resolutions. We don't see outside Friends of America coming together to arm opposition groups in America or to further divide the American public. That would be seen as just ridiculous. However, when it comes to the interior politics of Syria, for example, or Libya last year, this is an acceptable situation. Perhaps you can speak to the underlying hypocrisy of this.
I think the underlying hypocrisy, it has to do with racism and the idea that the U.S. is the police of the world and that it has a responsibility over everyone and is allowed to interfere in everybody else's life. And the self-righteous arrogance of people that they think that they know what is best for others. I see that a lot in these so-called activist groups that are, you know, supporting interventions into countries to save people when those interventions lead to more and more death. And it's not anything new. In the past, we've seen the same thing, but in terms of we have to save the world from communism, we have to educate these heathens in the way of Christianity. And, you know, you can take Christianity and put any religion or any ideology in there, and it's the same thing. You know, we have to save people from themselves. And the people do not have the right, no matter how good their intentions are, they do not have the right to interfere in other people's sovereign affairs. And they wouldn't want it for themselves, as you mentioned, but it seems to be acceptable to force it on others.
Well, obviously there's more going on beneath the surface here than is just what's being presented to the public. I mean, there is this glaring hypocrisy about the need to intervene in Syria, for example, or in Libya or in other states like that, but not, for example, in Zimbabwe, which is equally a ridiculous political situation, or Uganda, which has its own problems with Museveni, etc. But the same action and coordinated international effort isn't being applied there. And the obvious question is, why not? So what is your take on why Syria, for example, is seemingly next on the chopping block for the NATO humanitarian intervention?
Well, in fact, with Uganda, they already have 100 troops in there. And it's because of a threat of China.
But those troops are helping Museveni, not against Museveni.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely right. You know, that's the hypocrisy of it. these so-called pro-democracy, you know, Clinton and Obama, they're supposedly so pro-democracy that they're attacking these dictatorial states, when in fact they're allied themselves with Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia, being one of the most despotic dictatorships in the whole land, is screaming about democracy in Syria when they don't even have democracy for Saudi Arabia themselves. In fact, it's such a police state that even in that country, women are not allowed to drive. So it's so hypocritical. And at the same time, when democratic governments are elected that are not supportive of the U.S., for example, in Venezuela in 1973, and in recent times, Hamas in Palestine, the U.S. is the first to say, you know, that's not a real democracy. We say when it's a real democracy. I believe Rice was said, democracy isn't just when you're the most popular government. So these are her words. And when you even approach the subject, they will not answer. It's just a complete and utter hypocrisy.
Right. And as I was indicating, I think what this indicates is that there is something deeper to this. It's not about what they're saying it's about. It's not about protecting the people of Syria, obviously. It's about an agenda. What is that agenda in Syria? What is the next domino to fall?
That's a very good question. And I thank you for asking it. I believe that it's quite clear that the agenda is an Israeli agenda, and it is to control the region, to control the Levant, the Zionist idea of from the Nile to the Euphrates, and Syria being one of the last few remaining countries in the region, along with Iran, that actually opposes Israel's power and has a chance of opposing Israel's power. And all of these other governments that are dictatorial, that are oppressing their people, and even more so with the Bahrain and Saudi Arabia actually putting troops in Bahrain to suppress the uprising there. We don't hear about it from the US. All those states are pro-Israel, and they're pro the West, and that's why we don't hear about them. That's why we're hearing about Syria, because Syria is next on the chopping block. And in Libya, you know, Libya was too independent. They were selling their oil to China. They were selling their oil to Russia. They didn't toe the line, and they didn't have a big enough debt. So that is why these countries are being attacked.
Well, then let's talk about what should be happening here. Obviously, it would be great if the outside countries and forces at play just stopped providing the support to the Free Syrian Army, and one would assume that that it would collapse as a result of the lack of outside support and intervention. But given that that's very unlikely to happen, what do you think is likely to play out, and how do you think this could play out in a way that will protect Syrian sovereignty?
Well, for that, I want to just talk a little bit about what's happening right now. And today, one of the first days of the ceasefire, the opposition groups assassinated a general, and they assassinated, had a roadside bomb that killed some soldiers and a pilot. So I think what's going to play out is further antagonisms. There's going to be more bombings. I think that they want to create a climate of civil war. I think that they're going to, when these foreigners, if they allow foreigners in through the United Nations, it's going to exacerbate the situation. And I've heard from sources that they may try to enter snipers into Syria and start random shootings there. And it's an agent provocateur action to make it seem as though the government's just killing people willy-nilly, and even random people on the street, and these people need to be saved. That's the agenda. You kill people, and then you go in and to try to save them. And I feel that's what's going to happen. I can't imagine a NATO no-fly zone. People keep talking about a no-fly zone, but I don't feel that's going to happen for two reasons. One reason is Russia is opposed and Russia will veto. Second reason is Syria's air defense is actually quite powerful and would be able to take out a substantial amount of those planes, especially since we have the S-300 and perhaps S-400 missile, surface-to-air missile system that Russia sold us. So I think from its history, NATO and the US prefer to attack weak countries that can't fight back. So Syria is not one of those. I feel as though they would prefer to make it a Turkey-Syria war and step away from, you know, even Russia and the US might step back from each other and allow Syria and Turkey to fight it out. That might be a possibility. What I think would be ideal to happen is that people to back off Syria, allow the democratic reforms to take place, allow the elections to take place, which are to be held in June, I believe, and for sovereignty to be maintained. And the opening of Syria politically to be gradual. And for, I would, this is my idealistic hope, which probably won't happen, but I would like to see these opposition groups realize that the US do not have their best intentions at heart. They, at least they do not have Syria's best intention at heart. They've done it to Iraq. They've done the same thing to Libya. I hope they learn from history that there's no such thing as a liberator. And if they want to take power, that they're going to have to sell their soul for that. They're going to have to sell their country for that. And I hope they realize that that's something they should not do. And for them to lay down their arms and pursue peaceful means of, or at least even if they choose to fight for democracy, not to do so with the help of the enemy states whose only agenda is to make Syria into a slave country.
Well, then finally, let's talk a little bit to the people out there in the Western countries who themselves are not really supporters of the imperial agenda, but believe themselves to be supporters of freedom in Syria, or believe the rhetoric that's being applied here with the responsibility to protect and everything. What message do you have for the people who are trapped in that paradigm, who believe that what's going on here is for the best interests of the Syrian people?
I respect that they have good hearts and they probably have good intentions, but there's this old idiom that says the road to hell is paved in good intentions. And I think people who don't really understand the situation inside Syria, don't, haven't really lived there and seen the delicate balance that keeps the fabric of Syrian society together, that they should not interfere inside our internal affairs, because it will only lead to more destruction, and surely they don't want that. And I'd like for them to just respect the Syrians' right to decide their own future, and to just realize that external intervention is never the answer, no matter how dire the situation is, because external intervention will always make a dire situation worse. I just wanted to say that. Thank you.
All right, excellent. Well, a lot of information to go through, lots of issues to cover, so I certainly hope we can have you on again in the future to continue going through some of these issues. But just finally today, are there any websites or sources of information that you could direct people to who are looking for more reliable information about Syria and about some of the other crises going on in the region that are free from the same types of problems that the mainstream media has?
There is several websites. There's Syrian News CC. There is Syrian Youth English. That's a blog. And there's some YouTube channels, Syrians Worldwide. And they basically show you, they expose media lies. There's so much disinformation out there. And they just break down how blatantly obvious some of these lies are shown on Al Jazeera and CNN are, as well as showing up-to-date information of what's happening inside Syria. And maybe I'll post them to you.
All right, excellent. And I will post them in the notes for this interview. So, Syrian Girl, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, James.